Hey, everybody. Today we are exploring the space. We're exploring the sky, the space, the stars above. We are looking up and wondering. We are looking up and saying, how deep does it go? How far does it go? How far can we go? How many miles till we reach the edge? What happens after we die? We're not answering that question. What happens when we get to the edge of the universe and beyond? What is there but this? Those are literally the questions we're asking today. Why? Because we're looking at a book about those questions. We're looking at a book about that problem. We're looking at a book called The Berenstain Bears Reach for the Stars. It's a brand new book, 2025, just came out a few weeks ago. It contains dozens of astronomy facts. It contains dozens of facts. But how factual are these facts? How scientifically accurate is the new The Berenstain Bears Reach for the Stars? Do they get to the stars? Or do they land among the moons, shoot for the moons? Because even if you miss, at least you gave it a shot. That's what we have to say today. Does Mike Berenstain miss, or does he make it to the stars, and those stars being astronomy facts? Let's find out in the Berenstain Bear. I've never introduced a book like this before. Berenstain Bears Reach for the Stars. Welcome back to Deep in Bear Country, a Berenstain Bearcast. I am your host, Phil Gonzalez, and if you're watching along at home, I'm sorry to everyone who doesn't watch along at home. I'm sorry to every single person who chooses not to watch along at home. I'm sorry to everybody in listener land who's like, I can enjoy this book with my ears. I can enjoy this man with my ears. If this man were in front of me physically, I would close my eyes and just listen to him because that's the way I like to enjoy him. I apologize to everybody in advance because I'm going to discuss something you cannot see, and that is the fact that I am wearing a hooded shirt, a hooded sweatshirt, a hooded zip-up hoodie, as they call them in the UK, and I have the hood up. I look like one of those UK hoodies they always talk about in the newspapers. About the problem with the hoodie culture, problem with hoodies. Oh, I look like that now. So just to prove to you that you cannot trust a person by what they're wearing, I'm wearing my hoodie up. And you might think this person has nothing but bad designs on me, but I have nothing but good designs on you. I swear to the heavens above. And speaking of the heavens above, as we mentioned up top, today's book is all about the heavens above. It is the brand new for 2025, The Berenstain Bears Reach for the Stars. And we're going to reach for some stars while I preach a few bars about space, the space, about the space above us, the heavens above. People, okay, whenever the Berenstain Bears comes up in popular culture, which it doesn't, but whenever the Berenstain Bears comes up in popular culture, it's usually on like Reddit forums, and it's usually people either A, talking about the Mandela Effect, which is such old news. People were talking about the Mandela Effect around the time I started this show, and people still bring up that stupid, stupid thing called the Mandela Effect. And they're like, oh, it's a bear with an E, with an A. That's like the level of discourse. Or, oh, I swear to God, I was a kid, I was about Berenstain. That's like it, how it sounds like. It sounds like a bunch of ridiculous chickens cackling in my ear every time I see anything about the Mandela Effect. Give it up. Let it go. You're just wrong. Like it's just an excuse for people who are wrong. So they're either talking about the Mandela Effect or they're talking about the fact that the Berenstain Bears books are now written by the son of the originals. Like so they talk about that like the son took over, as if his parents didn't hire him on as another contributor to their books in the 1980s, as if Mike was this interloper who was like vulture like perched on a fence waiting for his parents to pass away, and then like when they were or like when they got too old he like seized on the property of the Berenstain Bears. They talk about how the Berenstain Bears has been taken over by the sun, their child, not like the sun, like not like the star above, which we'll get to, and that he's turned it into a right-wing propaganda, Christian conservative right-wing propaganda, which is Reddit way of saying he has some books about religion. But for Redditors, long, like massively online people think of religion as this sort of like nefarious thing that was only invented in the last 50 years just to bother them. But they also think of religion as something that exists separate from science, that he's trying to teach kids about to move away from facts and get into Christian ideology. Whereas Mike's religious books are pretty much all entirely be nice to each other, like be kind to each other and listen to your friends and behave as Jesus probably would have wanted you to, which is a nice person who loves their neighbor. Like that's basically the gist of like the religious books. Like, just be a decent person. It doesn't matter what you believe in as long as you're a decent person. I'm being interrupted. Hold on. I'm being interrupted. I have no idea where I was. I was recording. I was doing something. I have no idea what I was talking about. I had to take a phone call. The Berenstain Bears reach for the stars. I look like Emperor Palpatine. I guess is what I'm saying. I look like Emperor Palpatine when I'm looking at myself now. I don't look like an awesome kid in a hoodie because I'm not. I'm a lame human in a hoodie. I look like, I don't know what I look like. What do I look like with a hood on? Like, the worst boy. I look like the worst boy. In any case, the Berenstain Bears reach for the stars. This is the Mike Berenstain book. I don't remember what I was talking about. I got interrupted by a phone call. It was a very important phone call. I don't remember, but it was a very important phone call. So, excuse me having a life. What we're going to do is we're going to find out if this book is actually worth its salt. We're going to find out if this book is worth its weight. We're going to find out if this book is worth your time by taking a look at the actual science in this book. Here we go. The Berenstain Bears reach for the stars. Okay, so it starts off with a little poem. Just so you know, a little poem. I'm not going to read the book to you. I would never do that to you. I'm not going to read the book, but I'm going to read you this poem. It's the first part of the book. Usually I start the episode with this, but we're mixing things up because for the last few weeks I've been doing TV episodes. Beyond the moon, beyond the sun, let's travel as far as thought can run. So what we're doing right now is we're setting up. These kids are going to be exploring the stars, reaching for the stars, exploring space, but they're not going to really be doing that. They're not actually taking off in a rocket ship and exploring it. They're going as far as their thought can go, and their thought is infinite. Thoughts are infinite. You can think about anything forever. By the way, this book is by Mike Berenstain. Do you know it's based on characters created by Stan and Jan Berenstain? And then Mike, vulture-like, waited on a fence. Never mind. Yes, so the Berenstain Bears reach for the stars. So this is a book about two bears, brother and sister. This is brother and sister bear. It's a brother and sister-focused educational book. They're leaving Bear Country School. Brother is whistling. What I like in this book establishes a fact you did not know about sister. This book establishes a personality quirk of sisters you were not aware of. This book establishes that Sister Bear absolutely hates whistling. Brother's whistling a tune. Sister's not into that. It says it like right out there. It's like pretty much says like brother's whistling a tune. Sister ain't about that whistling life. She's not. But they start talking about who their favorite teachers are. And brother's like, oh, Teacher Jane, obviously. And which I'm sorry for your other teachers. But Teacher Jane, obviously. And sister's like, why Teacher Jane? He's like, well, she's stern. She's firm. But she's a good teacher. Like, she takes things seriously. She lets us, you know, have a good time. And she's a good teacher. She's a fun teacher. But she's also very serious. And she knows how to call, like, BS on the kids when they act up. She keeps kids in line. She's firm and stern. And as we know from the cartoon, she talks like this. Like, she kind of talks like this in the cartoon. Something like that. But we love it. And we love the fact that she teaches science. She's great at everything, but she's really good at teaching science. She's really good at making concepts in science like make sense to kids our age. And so the illustration they show for that is that Teacher Jane has a screen pulled down. There's an image on there. It says, Newton's third law of motion. For every action, there is an equal and opposite reaction. We see a cartoon drawing of a rocket ship. The thrust coming out the back of the rocket ship is labeled action, and the rocket ship moving forward is labeled reaction. And then up in the corner, we have a bear illustration of Sir Isaac Newton, who in this bear universe is called Sir Isaac Newton. No bear pun needed. But he's got the long locks, the wig, the white wig that Newton was famous for. And like Isaac Newton, his eyes seem to be firmly crossed. I don't know why Mike drew Sir Isaac Newton with crossed eyes, but there it is. So Newton's third law of motion. For every action, there is an equal and opposite reaction. That's a simplified version of the actual thing. But for kids, for little kids, this is a pretty good on-point illustration of Newton's third law. The rocket fuel is pushing out the back of the rocket ship, and the opposite reaction is the rocket ship moving in the opposite direction. The rocket is pushing against the air, forcing the rocket to move equally in the opposite direction. That's about as cut and dry as you could hope for as an illustration of equal and opposite reaction. And it's actually better than the illustrations that my teachers would use would be like pushing something, like pushing another person. But it was always hard to, like, there's a lot going on in there. Like, if you push a person, like, the amount of force you use, you're pushing against that, and their body is pushing back. And it was always complicated. Plus, there was a lot of emotions involved. Like, if I pushed a person over, why am I doing that? There's a story there. I don't need a story about a rocket ship. Rocket go boom. Rocket fly up. Rocket go boom. You land among the stars. That's all I need to know. Pretty good illustration, teacher Jane. Now, the kids love space. They love talking about space. They love thinking about space. And they especially love space grizzlies. In fact, we're back with the space grizzlies. We're back with the greatest IP invented by the Berenstain Bears, the space grizzlies, who've existed since the Berenstain Bears in the Bad Dream. They've existed in animated form. They've existed in storybooks. I assume if there was ever another Berenstain Bears TV series or movie, they would somehow work them in. But the Cubs are excited because they're going to watch the new Space Grizzlies movie. Remember, that's what the Berenstain Bears in the Bad Dream was all about. The Space Grizzlies movie was coming out. Well, this is a new movie in the Space Grizzlies series saga, I guess. I don't know. Are they related? Soft reboot? Who knows? But it's the Space Grizzlies and the robot zombies. So it's about robots. Okay, so the illustration is two of our Space Grizzlies, and they're like Space Grizzly, like, skidoos. And they're battling the robot zombies. Now, I want you to imagine, if you're not looking at the image, I want you to imagine in your brain what a robot zombie would look like in Bear World. Because these are robots, they're kind of built like Robo. Remember Robo from the Berenstain Bears chapter book about actual factual bringing a robot to life and then having to kill it with his own hands at the end because it became too intelligent or was violent. It was a violent robot. So I guess inspired by actual events that took place in Bear Town, these robots look kind of like Robo. They're definitely robot bears. They've got snouts and noses. But presumably they're also dead. Like, they're robot zombies, which means that they died at some point, like Robo. Perhaps they were all dismantled by their creators, have been brought back to life, which I guess is what makes them zombies. They're not robot revenants. They're not robot ghouls. They're not robot licks. They are robot zombies. So presumably, they're dead. They've been brought back to life. They crave flesh. The flesh of other robots? I don't know. That's what makes a zombie, right? Is that it craves the flesh of the animal that used to be, right? So we're getting into the weeds here with the robot zombies. Let's just leave it at the Cubs are excited about seeing this movie. I love to see that Sister has been taken into the fold completely. Remember in the past, she's been afraid of the Space Grizzlies movies, little intense. They also were intense enough. They made Brother have dreams about losing his clothes. Just leave it at that. So the kids are all excited. Here we go. Space Grizzlies and the Attack of the Robot Zombies. The kids sit that night, watch the movie on their beautiful flat screen television. They're all excited. I guess this movie played in the theaters, maybe. Then it went to streaming. I'm going to assume that's what happened. Or maybe it just went straight to streaming at this point. Maybe Netflix has some sort of deal, or Bearflix, whatever you call it, with the Space Grizzlies company. Maybe this is like He-Man and Netflix. Like, Netflix is producing all of He-Man stuff. They have the rights to, like, the production of new He-Man cartoons. That's why they did two He-Man cartoons in different continuities at the same time. They did one for little kids. They did one for, like, emotionally stunted adults, I guess, is the Kevin Smith one. It's not people seem to love it. I think it's fine. It's kind of trash. But now there's the He-Man movie coming out. So Space Grizzlies, sticking with that, I'm going to assume that there is streaming rights to the Space Grizzlies. They're creating new movies, new merchandise for the nostalgia market, but this one's aimed more at kids. So these are kids who've jumped on the Space Grizzlies train. After all, it's like 30 years since the first Space Grizzlies movie at this point. Mama and Papa ain't watching it. They don't care. So they're watching Space Grizzlies and the Attack of the Robot Zombies. And it's great. It's an exciting movie, but it gets the kids thinking. There's a lot of things mentioned in the movies, like quasars and galaxies, things that the kids aren't really like familiar with, like these more in-depth, not galaxies, but these more in-depth scientific astronomical concepts. And they're like, are these things based? They're like, what are quasars? They're like, maybe they're like lasers, quasar and laser don't really rhyme, but they're like, maybe they're like lasers, like the lasers they shoot each other with. So they don't really know, but they're wondering, are the concepts introduced in this fictional film based in reality, which is an amazing thing to wonder. We're treading in Neil deGrasse Tyson territory here. But unlike Neil deGrasse Tyson, the answers they get are not going to be simply to make them despise fiction. So they go to bed that night. They're laying in their bunk beds and they're talking about this. And they can't sleep because they're like, are these things real? Like, is any of this real? And they're like, you know what we can do? We can ask Teacher Jane tomorrow. She's always talking about space. She's always talking about the astronomy. She's always talking about the sky. She's talking about the stars. She's thinking about the stars. Her heads are in the clouds. Let's go talk to Teacher Jane. So the next day they tromp up to school and they confront her right away. They're like, we watched this movie. We want to know what is the deal. What's the deal with these quasars? What's the deal with the, oh my goodness. And behind Teacher Jane on her whiteboard is illustrations, presumably that she's drawn in dry erase marker for her next astronomy lesson. First we see a diagram she's drawn of a comet's orbit. So we have the sun, we have Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune, the eight planets. And then we have a comet orbit, which is okay, in the planets, it's not realistically, like, they're not drawn to scale, but it shows you, like, they're circular orbits, and we see this massively elliptical orbit around the sun with the comet tail pointing away from the sun every step of the way. It's a fairly accurate representation of a comet's orbit. Comets don't orbit within they're not within the planetary orbits. They sort of exist in their own thing. These are objects that have been captured by the gravity of the sun and the planets, and they're forced into an orbit around the sun, but that orbit can take just years and years and years and years. And the tail of the comet is the surface of the comet being burned off by the sun. And so it flies. It's going to fly in the opposite direction of the sun, no matter which way the comet is headed. The tail of the comet is not the tail of the comet in the sense that like a cat's tail is the tail of the cat. It is simply the ejecta of the surface of the comet like burning away into space. And it's if the comet is flying towards you, but the sun is behind is in front of you, then that comet's tail is going to be facing you, even though the comet's coming at you. Comets. Then we see a beautiful illustration of the Milky Way galaxy, again, presumably done in dry erase marker. So she spent some time on this. It's a colorful illustration of the Milky Way galaxy, showing the arms of the spirals of the galaxy, showing blotches and blobs, presumably based on like Hubble photographs, deep space telescope photographs. So we get some, but that's not true. That's not true. There's no photographs of the Milky Way galaxy. Remember that. There's no photographs of our galaxy because we'd have to send a camera outside our galaxy to get a shot. So what we know is basically what it looks like based on our photographs of other galaxies. So I'm assuming she's basing this illustration she's drawing off of photographs taken by deep space telescopes or orbital telescopes of other spiral arm galaxies that are like the Milky Way. So that's what she's drawing. But she has drawn a dot or a line leading to like an infinitesimal point in the Milky Way drawing that says our sun. Because remember, there's 100 billion stars in our galaxy. Our sun is but one of them. Okay? Then up above that is an illustration she's done. Again, presumably in dry erase marker of space. And floating in space, and this dry erase marker is presuming some watercolor-like textures, I'm going to say, on this whiteboard. Nestled in this blob of space, she has drawn our galaxy, a small representation of the Milky Way galaxy, but also the Andromeda galaxy and the Triangulum galaxy. And there's a label that says the local group of galaxies. And yes, that is the local group of galaxies. There's three galaxies, our galaxy, the Andromeda galaxy, and the Triangulum galaxy. There are three galaxies that exist close together. Galaxies tend to group, bunch up by gravity. They attract each other with their gravity. Remember, there's 100 billion stars in our galaxy, 100 billion galaxies that we know of in space. Like if you take a picture of space with a deep space telescope and you look at that and you see literally 100,000 dots in that image, those dots are all galaxies. They're galaxies. They're not stars. They're galaxies. There's just so many galaxies. And they clump up. They clump up. Like teenagers at a dance. They group up by gravity. And then below that is a simplified, a grossly simplified, but appropriately simplified diagram of the structure of a black hole. It says black hole structure. Won't you cruxure? And something, something. I don't remember the lyrics to the song, but black hole side, won't you come and wash away the rain? Is that what it is? How can black hole wash away the rain? All I remember is being a little freaked out by the video for Black Hole Sun. Watch it on YouTube if you get a chance. It's a little freaky. It uses like really early morphing technology to like distort people's faces. But at the time, it was freaky. Now, at the time, I was also like almost an adult or an adult. So it's sort of embarrassing that it was freaky. But those visuals were creepy. The people's eyes got big. Black hole structure. We see the photon sphere, we see the event horizon, and we see the singularity. And that's really all it says. It's you see a photon sphere, you see a drawing of a circle as the event horizon, and then within the event horizon is the singularity. We'll get into that if we get into that. But as far as the structure of a black hole, for the illustration purposes of a bunch of nine-year-olds, spot on. Like spot, great. This is a great place to begin your discussion of a black hole, which is usually horrifically misrepresented in popular culture. So Teacher Jane's like, look, we can't go into space. None of you guys are ever going to go into space. That's a pipe dream, a fool's fantasy. But we can pretend to go, so close your eyes. I have a make-believe rocket ship. I have a make-believe rocket ship called the Cosmos One. Let's get in. It's a cartoon Willy Wonka-esque contraption. But we're going to magic school bus our way into the night sky. Copyright not violated. This is not, you cannot copyright an idea. I can take my kids on a whimsical imaginary journey into science. It's not a violation of Miss Frizzle or her niece. Was the latest magic school bus is like her niece or her daughter, her granddaughter. I don't remember. But in any case, we're going to whisk you away. We're going to whisk you away like the kids in Weapons. And take you on a magical adventure up into the cosmos in our minds, in a yellow vehicle that is not a school bus. So they go imaginary flying up. They fly away from the Earth, which is being orbited by the moon. We see the sun. We see Mercury. We see Venus. They go flying up past Mars, Jupiter, Saturn. And we see a nice diagram of our solar system. We see the Sun, Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars. We see the asteroid belt between Mars and Jupiter, which is there and is massive. Saturn, Uranus, Neptune, right? But then outside the solar, like that part of the solar system proper, we have a cluster, like a full ring around the solar system called dwarf planets. And within the dwarf planets, we have two named objects, Pluto and Eris, which are two of the more massive dwarf planets out there. Now, Pluto, as you know, for many years was considered a planet, a primary planet, a main planet. But then the dwarf planets were discovered. And they realized that this thing that is Pluto is not as singular as they thought. And that if they were going to keep Pluto a planet, then they would have to incorporate a lot more of these things as planets. And it was actually smarter from a scientific standpoint, from a categorizational standpoint, to change Pluto's status from planet to dwarf planet, which is fine. It's just that there's a lot of those. In fact, Uranus has a moon that is about the same size as Pluto And that used to be a dwarf planet. Like, that's how small these things are. Like, Pluto is small, and it's far away, and it's an active planet. It's a real planet. Like, it's a dwarf planet. Like, being a moon, being a dwarf planet, there is no shame in that. That is simply nomenclature. It is simply what they need to call you, else kids would have to memorize all 250 planets in the solar system. Like, and that's not going to happen. There's not that many educated mothers who just gave us 9 pizzas to cover all the planets if they included dwarf planets. So we're going with that. But I like that it shows it's, again, it's not to scale. If you were to make a scale model, they've made scale models of the solar system. They exist on the Earth. Like, people have made scale models of the solar system. And those things have to be as big as a city. Like, they are enormous. That's how vast the distance between planets is. Like, you can't, if you have like a basketball as the sun, like, Mercury is going to be like the size of a pea or like a pinhead, and it's going to have to be like half a mile away just to make it scale. And there are cities that have done this, and you have to travel the city to find the next planet because scale is whopping. So this is not a scale drawing, but it is a somewhat accurate drawing as far as showing you the order of things and showing you that Pluto and Eris are dwarf planets. But like, you know, like I think it's, is it Neptune or is it Uranus? One of the two. I think it's Neptune that has the moon. Neptune has the moon that used to be a dwarf planet. That has like a bizarre, more bizarre orbit. I think it's Neptune. Neptune has the really bizarre orbit because it varies its distance from the Earth, from the sun, like a lot. And sometimes Pluto would be closer to the sun than Neptune. It was always a little wonky. When you get Pluto out of the picture, though, it's not as big a deal. But in this illustration, doesn't show that. It shows perfectly circular orbits for all the planets. But that's not what we're talking about. We're just talking about the order of things. So they go flying. Now, Teacher Jane is like, okay, we're going to have to pretend not just that we're in space, but that we're going faster than the speed of light. And the speed of light, and there's an illustration of a flashlight, and the light shining from it has a little miles per hour thing, 671 miles per hour, which is not, 671 million miles per hour, sorry, not 671 miles per hour. Supersonic jets don't go faster than light. 671 isn't really the speed of light. It's 670.6, yada, yada, yada. Rounding it up to 671 for a bunch of children, though, that's fine. Easier to comprehend. She's like, you can't go faster than light. As we learn from the movie Event Horizon, you can't go faster than light. If you want to go faster than light, you really have to fold space. Hold on. I'll get a magazine I can fold in half and poke a pencil through to prove that. Never mind. You can't go faster than light. You can't arrive somewhere before your image arrives there. That can't happen. It is physically, scientifically impossible to travel faster than the speed of light. You would simply stop. You simply would not be. You would gradually approach the speed of light until you existed in another, like, concept of time. So she says, let's pretend we can, though, because we wouldn't survive this trip otherwise. Because we're going to visit our nearest neighbor. We're going to visit Proxima Centauri. And Proxima Centauri is our closest star neighbor. It is a star that is, hold on, I'm going to look this up. I'm going to look it up just for you. Proxima Centauri distance. Proxima Centauri is 4.24 light years away. So 5.88 trillion miles away. That is our closest star, right? Yes. Alpha Centauri is the closest system. Proxima Centauri is the closest star in that system, 5.88 trillion miles away. So she's like, let's pretend we can travel faster than the speed of light. Let's pretend it doesn't take us almost 5 years to get there. We're going faster than the speed of light. There it is. There's Proxima Centauri. Centauri. I'm not sure. I don't care. Who cares? Proxima Centauri has a planetary system. 3 planets orbiting around it. These planets are called D, B, and the disputed C. There might not be a C. It's very hard to see that far across the galaxy. There might be a C, but we know that there's A and there's D and there's B. D and B, what are they? D, B, D and B. Planet D, a confirmed exoplanet orbiting Proxima Centauri, the closest star to the sun. And planet B, an exoplanet orbiting within the habitable zone, which means it could have life, but it probably doesn't. So moving on. So that's totally accurate. Teacher Jane doesn't go into the disputed planet C. She doesn't go into it. She's like, not even important. But whoa, what are we coming up on here? We're coming up on the galaxy. So now we're past this. We're outside. Suddenly there's no stars around. There's just galaxies. Suddenly we're in the local galaxy cluster, the Andromeda, the Milky Way, and the Triangulum Galaxy. Just right there. You hear about the Andromeda Galaxy a lot. I feel like we hear about the Andromeda Galaxy a lot. I feel like we're always talking about the Andromeda Galaxy and the Triangulum Galaxy. It's never even mentioned. No one's like, let's pip on over to Triangulum. They're always like, let's pip on over to the Andromeda Galaxy in science fiction stories. But Triangulum is named for the constellation in which it sits. Constellation Triangulum, which you might be interested in knowing, is Latin for triangle. Named after the three brightest stars in the constellation. There's three of them. They make a triangle because there's three of them. So Triangulum is in Triangulum, the Triangulum Galaxy. It's the third largest member of the local group of galaxies behind the Andromeda and the Milky Way. The local group of galaxies, by the way, it consists of two collections of galaxies. So the Milky Way and its satellites, the Andromeda and its satellites are the other lobes. There's two lobes. So our galactic cluster is part of the Virgo supercluster, which might be part of the Laniakea supercluster. There's a lot of, like, you mush things together. So our satellite galaxy, so we have a galaxy. We're in a galaxy. Our galaxy system consists of the Sagittarius dwarf galaxy, the large Magellanic Cloud, the small Magellanic Cloud, Canis Major dwarf galaxy, disputed. Some say it's not a galaxy. Ursa Minor dwarf galaxy, Draco dwarf galaxy, Carina dwarf galaxy, Sextans dwarf galaxy, Sculptor dwarf galaxy, Fornax dwarf galaxy, Leo the First, a dwarf galaxy, Leo the Second, a dwarf galaxy, Ursa Major 1 dwarf galaxy, and Ursa Major 2 dwarf galaxy, and then several additional ultra faint dwarf spheroidal galaxies. Now, the Triangulum is the third largest. And no one's really sure if Triangulum is actually connected to the Andromeda or is its own cluster. They're about 750,000 light years apart, so they're really close on like an astronomic scale. And they experienced a close passage 2 to 4 billion years ago, which triggered star formation across Andromeda's disk, which is why in the Andromeda Galaxy, you see these young stars on near the outside. The Pisces dwarf galaxy, though, is equidistant from the Andromeda Galaxy and the Triangulum, so it could be a satellite of either. It's hard to tell in a lifetime of a human being how the galaxies move in relation to each other, because they're moving very fast across vast distances, but they're so far away and they're so far apart and space is so huge that they could move trillions of miles and you wouldn't even notice because they're so vast, which is why we have to rely on redshift and other things to figure out where and how fast and how far they're all moving. But as far as Teacher Jane's illustration goes, it's pretty smart. And I love that the Milky Way Galaxy and the Andromeda Galaxy show their galactic clusters, and that the Triangulum Galaxy, just by itself, could be part of another cluster, could be part of Andromeda Cluster. Teacher Jane is smart enough to know, don't hammer yourself down to one theory. We are scientists. We are not know-it-all-itises. So they continue on, and then they get to the edge of the universe, right? Restaurants and all. The edge of known space. And here we see quasars, elliptical galaxies, spiral galaxies. And we see this sort of like cone of travel they've taken. There's the Milky Way, the spirals, ellipticals. Now we're out amongst the quasars. And this is smart. This is a smart way to do it because quasars can serve as like outer markers of the visible universe because they are among the most distant observable objects, quasars. But what is quasar? We're all wondering that. What is a quasar? It's a super bright object in space. It's at the center. Quasars form at the center of galaxies. So in the middle of the galaxy sits a supermassive black hole, millions or billions of times heavier, has more mass than our own sun. And supermassive black holes are in the middle of, they think, most galaxies. So it's a supermassive black hole. It's just constantly pulling in dust and gas, right? Which don't fall like into it like a hole, but they orbit around it really fast. And the faster they orbit, the closer to the singularity they get, the faster and faster, approaching the speed of light. They get squished because of all the pressure. They get hot because of all the pressure until they glow brighter. Like they just get more and more pressure, more and more heat. They're glowing brighter than all the stars in that galaxy combined. And they're shooting off all this light, and that is a quasar, a quasi-stellar radio source, because early astronomers were like, are those stars? What are we looking at? What are those stars? They're so bright, we can see them from billions of light years away, but because they're billions of light years away, what we're seeing happened billions of years ago, because that's how long it took the light to get to us. But it's a good way of us knowing what the universe looked like in its early days. Like the further away something is when you're looking at it, the more clues it's giving you as to what it was like back then. Because it takes that light. It's bizarre to think about. So the energy they give off is massive. Some of them shine hundreds of times brighter than all the stars in the Milky Way put together. Which is just, but no wonder we discovered them. And yes, so they are super bright beacons from ancient galaxies. And that's it. So they I'm just going to look at a picture of a quasar. An artist's representation of quasars. I'm looking at the way artists have drawn quasars. And they do. They look like galaxies with supermassive black holes in the center. And these giant beams shooting out from the disk on either side of the disk. So they look like wheels mounted on huge axles, huge light axles. That's how an artist usually represents a quasar. And that's what Mike has drawn, just dozens upon dozens of these galaxies. So the accretion disk of the black hole is shooting out this imagery. We have X-ray images of quasars that you can see. Like here's the blast of energy. It's an X-ray jet. It extends at least a million light years from the quasar. I just find that this is just it's bizarre and fascinating and informative. And Mike has done the world of children an educational favor in really lingering on quasars, because this is something that we don't talk about a lot with kids, quasars. But it's worth knowing and it's easily explained. This book does a good job of just sort of like giving you the lowdown. So then they're moving back. They're coming back. They pass the quasars, pass the galaxies. We're back into the Milky Way. We pass the Kuiper Belt. We pass the asteroids, and we're flying in back home. And the kids are like, Teacher Jane, this is amazing. Thank you so much for answering our questions. Although she didn't mention space grizzlies, but maybe one day we could become astronauts and go explore this stuff. She's like, you could, or, and I love that she does this. She's like, you could become astronauts, or you could become astronomers who are scientists who study the night sky, who study space. You could do astronomy, which is a science that we actually need more of than astronauts. So, I mean, she doesn't say that, but that's the implication. And they're like, ooh, yeah, astronomers. It's much more. Most people will never go into space. Most people will never go up into outer space. Most people are stuck on the ground. And if you want to get into space, one of the best ways to do it is to look up. Look up with a giant lens and take a look at the things above you. That's your first step into getting into space. Sometimes your final step is becoming an astronomer. and realizing that there's a lot you can tell about space without actually going there, because you have to, because we can't actually go there. We can go a little ways into space, but not into outer space. That's way out there. We've pretty much gone as far as the moon. That's as far as we've gone. People have gone. So that's it. That's the Berenstain Bears reached for the stars. They reached for the stars and they got there. Now, the big question, how scientifically accurate is this? The big question, is this worth putting on your kid's bookshelf? The big question, is this a good book? Is this worth reading? Yes, yes, and yes. Scientific accuracy, about as accurate as you need for kids this age, about as accurate as you need for kids to start asking other questions. I think this book could even have a supplementary thing in the back with more in-depth discussion about these details. But it's a good place to start. It covers a lot. It covers just like point A to point B back to point A of what you're going to run into. And then there's a lot of room for questions in between. And if your kids have questions, they can ask them. You can find even more in-depth books about the subject. Illustrations, Jorgas. These are amazing illustrations. Mike has really gone out of his way to make space seem colorful and interesting. I love it. Character building, not a whole lot, although we do learn more about Teacher Jane, her love of science, her love of astronomy, her love of space, and a nice message at the end, which is you don't have to go into space to study space. You don't have to be a hotshot astronaut in the captain's chair to be a space scientist. Space scientists are all down here, almost all down here on Earth, looking up through their telescopes, through their radars, through their X-ray scopes, whatever they do, radio telescopes. Crunching numbers, figuring things out, making discoveries every day. There's stuff out there that we've never seen, that we haven't seen yet, that's just waiting to be discovered. So if Mike's goal in the Berenstain Bears Reach for the Stars was to foster an interest in astronomy, he did it. If Mike's goal in the Berenstain Bears Reach for the Stars is to push a conservative religious agenda, he failed miserably. He's not very good at it, because this just made me interested in real science, hard science, good science. Axe is a good illustration of how a child's interest in fiction, in cartoons and stuff like that, can lead to an interest in solid science. Because you start asking questions at a certain age about, like, how plausible is this? And if we can't do this, what can we do? And if we don't actually know this, what do we know? And what can we find out? And how do we find those things out? And that's science, baby! So, thank you so much for joining me. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you so much for taking part in this madcap adventure. I'll be back later with more Berenstain Bears goodness. I'll be back with more Berenstain Bears episodes. I'll be back with more Berenstain Bears stuff. I hope to be talking to Mike soon about some of the stuff that's been going on in the world of the Berenstain Bears. I'm not going to be wearing a hoodie next time you see me. I'm wearing a hoodie because my hair looks terrible. And if you're listening along at home, trust me, I'm wearing a hoodie. And I'll see you all next time deep in Bear Country.